If you're a reasonably smart person and you're willing to work, three jobs, work 24/7 around the clock, I think you can develop a level of success. But I think the idea is, and there's been a lot of books written about this, and I think this applies not only, it applies to all of the people in your life, not only your friends, your employees, your partners, your customers, your clients, whatever people refer to their, the people that do, they do business with as patients, if you're a doctor, whatever, it's there.
You are listening to Fingerprints on Success, the podcast dedicated to highlighting unique imprints left by business leaders, mentors, and successful entrepreneurs. In this show, we'll be bringing on a diverse range of serial entrepreneurs, professionals, leaders, and coaches to uncover the secrets behind achieving success both professionally and personally. Guiding you on this podcast is none other than Bill Barrett, an award-winning corporate and business law attorney and CEO of the law firm Mandelbaum Barrett PC, where he and his team have provided a full array of legal services to both businesses and individuals throughout the country. Get ready and let's get to the show.
On today's show, I'm thrilled to introduce a longtime friend and a maestro of success, Mark B. Murphy. In the world of finance and entrepreneurship, Mark stands as a beacon of accomplishment, holding titles like CEO, author, Forbes number one financial security professional, speaker, motivator, and entrepreneur. Leading Northeast Private Client Group, his expertise in innovative financial planning and wealth management is unmatched. Mark's book, The Ultimate Investment, holds the number one bestseller on Amazon position, and his podcast, The Hero of the Hour, is in the top 40 in the United States in business and entrepreneurship. Join us as we unravel the fingerprints on success of Mark B. Murphy. Mark Murphy, welcome to Fingerprints on Success. How are you doing today?
Bill, I'm doing terrific. I couldn't be better.
Well, I really appreciate you having the time to spend with us today. And, for those people, Mark, who don't know you, give us a little bit of a background on how you got to where you are now. I mean, right now, you are literally ranked as one of the top financial advisors in the United States of America. And that's just not from, my view. That's through Forbes and other accolades. I know that you've been number one in Guardian numerous times over many years in one of the most competitive and difficult professions, and you've built this organization. Share with our listeners the journey of Mark Murphy. Like, how'd you even get into being the financial advisor that you are today?
Well, if you listen to Forbes magazine, I guess I'm the number three financial advisor in the country. So I was hoping to come on this podcast to see what we could do about getting rid of the first two. But I think the most important thing about that is that I think what I wake up every day is you always have to remember where you came from. Bill, I grew up dumb and broke in Suffern, New York. And the firm that I now, run and own right now, I came on board right out of the Kelley Business School at Indiana University. And they offered me $1,000 a month. Oh, by the way, that wasn't $1,000 a month salary. That was $1,000 a month draw.
That'll get you a lot of ramen. That'll get you a lot of ramen noodles.
And so I took the job because it was $1,000 a month more than I was making at the time. At the end of the day, it's, I think you always, you get to a point, no matter how much success that you've had, and you've had a tremendous amount of success. I mean, for Christ's sake, your firm after almost 100 years changed the name of the firm to put your name in it. It's right over your left shoulder there. And so the idea is you've experienced the same thing. But I think there's nothing more, I think, ugly than when somebody who's had the kind of success we've had, where they kind of say they look in the mirror every day and they love what they see. They believe their own BS and their own story. And I think that, the great thing about today is that I'm going to wake up every day and try to be the best version of me I can be. And what's great about that is that I'm not competing against anybody else. I'm competing against the best version of me. But what the best thing of that is that I can then be the greatest cheerleader, friend, and supporter of everybody in my world, because they're not my competitors. If I care about you, if you're a good person, something good happens to me, I want something great to happen to you. If I've got a dollar, I hope you have 100. I just want to play from an abundance place. And there's no jealousy or no competition or there's no anything. And I think it's so freeing because it allows you to have a great day every day. And you wake up every day trying to improve the lives of all the people you touch.
Yeah. You know, I've always been struck by the fact, because I've gotten calls from these people sometimes where, you know, people that I guess in theory, well, not even in theory, are people who are your quote competitors, other advisory firms, you know, where you're helping them and teaching them and mentoring them. And they're not part of your organization. They're just guys that are and gals that are trying to develop their careers. And I've seen many times that you spend time, you know, for what it's worth, that in and of itself is very unique, especially in a wildly competitive environment.
The only place I would say I'm competitive other than with myself, and I think this is really about being competitive with yourself, is one of the things you want to do is when you give away your intellectual property to let's people that would be perceived as your competitors or people in your industry, it does a few things. Remember, I never want to solve one problem when I can solve three or four at the same time by doing that. And the first thing it does is, again, if you want to learn a subject at a deep level, teach it to somebody else. So it allows me to teach it to peers and allows me to get even better. The second thing is when I give away my intellectual property, what it really does is it challenges me to create more property. You know, I don't think there's any secrets anywhere that every day, like, so now I've given you what I'm doing. So now I'm now challenged to go find out something I could do that's even better. And the other thing I think is, and I don't know if this is about turning 60, or I don't know if this is about some epiphany or something. I think I've always sort of been this way. But at some point is, at the end of the day, what do you want people, when they talk about you, what do you want people to say about you? And what I'd love people to say about me, I'd love to say a lot of things about me, and hopefully some of it good. But I would like to say that maybe what we did is we changed the lives of everybody we touched. That maybe by myself and maybe just the two of us, we can change a lot of lives. But if we have the attitude of that abundant attitude, maybe we could change the lives and the attitude and the culture of maybe a billion people, 100 million people. I mean, I don't know what the number, an infinite number of people, and just make the world a little bit better place for our kids and grandkids and a little bit better place in the world and to see a better universe. And it sounds kind of airy-fairy, but again, at the end of the day, what's it about? Is it about that you made more money than anybody else, or you had a bigger house than anybody else, or you did this? Or, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think any of that stuff matters. I think that Eckhart Tolle has this amazing thing. He says something, and I'm paraphrasing Eckhart, but he says something to the effect of, in this life, you have two suitcases in this world. And the one suitcase is the egoic one that says, you know, I've made all of this money, or I'm the president of this, or I'm the managing partner of Mandelbaum Barrett, or I'm this or I'm that, all those egoic things. And you can't take that with you. Those are all egoic things, and they stay here on Earth. But what he says is the other suitcase is, he says, when you realize that who you are is all you've got, then you can decide the kind of person you want to be. I just try to look at the kind of person that I want to be and the way I show up. And by the way, I'm far from perfect. I have bad days. I get angry. I'm frustrated. I do all kinds of things. And, you know, all I can do is just, you know, make sure I'm better tomorrow.
Yeah, no, I think that when you describe abundance, which is what you're describing, versus scarcity, it always strikes me. I mean, I guess it exists everywhere with people in general. I've always found that lawyers in my profession are maybe the worst at that, in terms of so many of them come from scarcity. They think there's only so many clients out there. There's only so much business I can get. There's only so much work I can get. And I'm in competition with everybody else. And it's just such the wrong mindset in any profession, in any business that you're in. Over and over, you see that an abundant attitude and helping, you know, I'm always happy to give the store away, so to speak, to friendly competitors, so to speak. I don't even like to use the word competitors, but colleagues. And it's encouraging. There are good people out there. And I think what you're doing, you know, you're also creating a culture within your own organization of trying to create that as a standard, that abundance is the standard that you're trying to create, which I think is awesome. I have a question for you, Mark. You know, I've read your book, of course, The Ultimate Investment. And
I'll let my mother know someone else read it besides her, so I actually feel very good about that.
That's right. And it's a number one rated book on Amazon, I might add. And there's a lot of great stuff in there. But one of the things I thought would be nice for you to share with our listeners and all the entrepreneurs that are listening to our program is, like, when you reflect on your success and building, you know, a financial advisory firm of the size of your firm that continues to grow exponentially, when you reflect back, are there one or two kind of like key principles or mindsets that maybe you didn't even know you had at the time, but that when you look back on it, you say, you know, because of these couple of things, these things were critical to my success. Is there anything like that you could share with the listeners?
I think that the interesting thing, I think in the early part of your career, when you're in your early 20s, maybe even into your early 30s, you know, if you're a reasonably smart person and you're willing to work, you know, three jobs, you know, work 24/7 around the clock, I think you can develop a level of success. But I think the idea is that when you know, and there's been a lot of books written about this, and I think this applies not only, it applies to all of the people in your life, not only your friends, your employees, your partners, your customers, your clients, you know, whatever people refer to the people that they do business with as patients, if you're a doctor, you know, whatever, it's there, is I think that you get to a point where you can only work so hard. And I'm finding now, as I got into my late 40s and then into my 50s, that a lot of the guys that I grew up with were getting burned out. I think they were getting burned out. And I think it was because a few things. One is they stopped being endlessly curious. I think the second thing, though, is that, you know, I don't want to think about it. I want to say this in the way I want to say it. But I think that that you realize that you're one person, and in many organizations, you become the funnel. So if it became the Mark Murphy show, at some point, I couldn't work around the clock for my entire life. There was only 24 hours in a day. There was only so much I could do. And when I started to invest in other people, and I truly, you know, and again, there's been lots of books written about that. But the idea is that, you know, they say they talk about that there's givers and there's takers and there's matchers. And we all know, Bill, people that are takers, like they'll come into a relationship just to glom and get whatever they want. Yep. And immediately they get a little bit of an advantage. And then there are matchers. And the matchers, to me, I hate them even more than the takers, because the takers are transparent. The matchers are, you know what, Mark, I'm going to be nice to you because you can help me. Or I'm not going to be nice to you because you can't help me. They're only going to match what I can do. So, you know, they're there kissing my backside because of all the things I can do for them. And I actually, those people bother me. But the givers, and I'm not talking about being a giver for a few months or even a few years, but I'm talking about for decades. If you pour yourself into other people and show up as you are, you then develop an army of people who want to do and help you out. And so the idea is, to me, and by the way, it creates a culture where everybody wants to give. And that's how real abundance happens. Because if the world is just a bunch of matchers and takers, you know, you're not going to do very well, but the givers are always the best. And so what I always encourage people that when they think sometimes that's foolish to be a giver, that there's a way that the world always has that come back to you tenfold. You know, that you always succeed by doing that. You know, I always remark sometimes when I get asked to speak at a conference, let's say a financial services and so people always want to acquire new clients. And so you'll sit back and you'll have like three or four speakers in front of you, and they'll talk about how to get referrals or how to get more clients or that kind of stuff. And my talk is always about how to give referrals. Mm-hmm. Or I had to help other people to go build their business and to do all those other things. And I think one of the things we have in common is, you know, after the amount of years we've done this business together or separately and together, we've got an army of people who want to help us. And by the way, not everybody will help us. The other thing, you don't become attached to the outcome. Sometimes, you know, some people that are takers or matchers, that's okay. You know, that's their life and their journey. And we want to have our journey of abundance. We want to be who true to who we are.
No, I think that's a great approach to it. And look, you know, you're right too about the only so many hours in a day. And, you know, in order to scale any company, any business, any service, you know, there has to be an army of like-minded people that are executing on the same vision and the same dream with the same culture. So I think that's really a philosophy to live by. But I'm going to flip it around on you now, because you do have a long history and a body of work. And the one thing we all know is it doesn't always go perfectly. If you could tell our entrepreneurs that are listening, kind of when you reflect on the success that you've had pitfalls, blind spots, or maybe if you could kind of advise, you know, if Mark Murphy today could advise Mark Murphy a decade or two ago, what are maybe some of the things you wouldn't do or some of the things that you would avoid?
First of all, I spent too much time in my 20s, 30s, maybe into my 40s, worrying about things that never happened. I used a lot of energy with total worry, and I could have used that time much more productively than doing that. And, you know, like we always have our story. Like I love telling the story when I was like 25 years old or something, where like I remember I was very excited about this meeting, and I confirmed it twice. And I drove 2 hours to the meeting in like a heavy rainstorm in traffic. And I rang out the people's doorbell and I saw all the lights in the house go out. And when I was peeking in their living room, I actually saw them kind of crawling on their hands and knees across the kitchen table, not to see me. Or I remember, cold calling in the 1980s. That's where I learned most of the four-letter words that I now know. You know, where you call somebody, you know, when you start in a business, you have no clients. You know, 40 years ago, you get on the phone. You know, you remember those two magic words people would use to cold callers back then. They don't, you know, you can't do that anymore with screening and calling. And you know, those two words, and the second word is you, and the first word is not thank. You know, it turns the place, and you come back to that place, and you remember. So now, when you have, you know, you built the kind of business we built, I actually find more joy in that, and I find that funnier than, you know, some of the great things that happened. And I think the part of it is you've got to have a support system and mentors. So, you know, like I would have, you know, back then in my 20s, we didn't know each other, you know, 40 years ago, but I had like a few guys that I would talk to. So I wouldn't call him when I made some big sale or bought on some big client or did something extraordinary. I wouldn't share it with him, but I couldn't wait to call him and tell him about that story, you know, where the guy cursed me out on the phone, or the guy, you know, turned the lights out on the house or something like that. And I think part of it is you just want to, you want to have fun with that. So either, you know, either when something bad happens, I think you can either get a pint of Häagen-Dazs, get a blanket and crawl under the covers and never come out, or you can actually find it hysterical and just enjoy the stuff and just come back and fight the next day and make sure it doesn't happen again. And I think part of it is, you know, that I think people also get burned out or are not as successful. It's not that they're not good at what they do or don't have the passion, but I want to have fun with it every day. I want to have fun on this podcast. Meaning, if you and I hopefully are giving people a little bit of wisdom and hopefully an interesting conversation. But if we can't have a couple of laughs along the way, count me out. I'd rather not do that. You know, I don't know. What about you? What do you think?
Well, you just made me think of a story that makes me laugh because I could so relate to what you're saying. And I remember I wasn't even a partner yet at the firm. I was an associate. And this guy tells me that he's got this huge lead for me with, at the time it was Chubb Insurance Company. And that basically he describes it like his friend is the decision maker. It's a done deal. Like, I'm going to get this big account. And I, like I said, I'm not even a partner, but I'm, you know, and I'm really green at the time. So I decide to bring my mentor, Mr. Mandelbaum, to this meeting because I'm, you know, it's going to be a shoo-in. And I tell him all about how guaranteed this is and how, you know, I give him the whole background that this friend of mine told me. So I drag him to this meeting and, you know, we get to the meeting, and the meeting, it becomes immediately clear, if you're paying attention at all, that there's no chance that they're actually trying to make the meeting go poorly, because there's no chance that I was ever getting this account. and they start cross-examining my mentor, you know, whose name is on the door, like a defendant. As opposed to a colleague or a professional. And on the way home, I could have crawled under the seat of the car and died, because it was like awkward silence. And I was like, oh my God, he's going to kill me. And I just, you know, it also taught me to kind of temper my expectations whenever I had an opportunity, and, you know, and never assume that anything is going to be that easy, but also to be very judicious about when you bring your boss with you somewhere.
Yeah, but I, again, knowing Barry like I do, my guess is he had, you know, unless he hadn't slept in 3 days, he had total compassion for that, because 30 years before that, he had been in the same situation himself, right? You know, and that's why I think you and I have compassion for some of our young guys. Like I viscerally, you know, here's, you know, when you work here, I viscerally have contempt for people that get out scrapped and get out hustled, you know, meaning meaning if you make a hustle mistake, that's no bueno in my world. But I make mistakes every day. And so when I make a mistake and people make mistakes every day and people are, when they're out there hustling, if I make a mistake or it doesn't go well, if I make a mistake, I apologize. I clean up my mess, you know, and I make sure it never happens again. And I think with people like, you know, like, or I've had people like in our organization take me out on something that was kind of similar. And I quote the great Ted Lasso line where they say, what's the happiest animal in the world, in the world? Do you know the answer?
No.
It's a goldfish because they have a 10 second memory.
So you
and Barry went to that meeting. It was a flipping disaster. And, you know, I don't know, 20 years later, your name's on the door and you're one of the most successful, you know, attorneys, key business strategists, critical thinkers in the country. Worked out okay. You know, where, by the way, I think a guy who was a lesser man than you would have, like, as I said, done their version of gotten a pint of Haagen-Dazs, crawled under the covers and never gotten up for 3 days. You know,
I really learned how to vet opportunities from that experience where, you know, I learned how to ask a lot of questions before I pulled in the cavalry. That's for sure.
Enjoying the show so far? We've received fantastic feedback since we started, and we love your questions. Entrepreneurs face unique challenges, and as a corporate attorney and CEO, Bill understands that. Whether it's your first location, industry regulations, succession plans, or exit strategies for your business, the journey is rarely a smooth one. Mandelbaum Barrett PC offers listeners of this podcast a 20-minute consultation with their award-winning team. From mergers and acquisitions to litigation, they help entrepreneurs navigate new opportunities, get invaluable insights, and support to not just survive, but thrive. Click the link in the episode description or visit mblawfirm.com for details. Once again, it's mblawfirm.com. Now, back to our show.
So since we're talking about mentors, let me segue into mentors. When you think back, there's always exceptions to everything. But one of the things I've always found consistent with every very successful client, entrepreneur that I've worked with, people in and out of my organization, myself included, people that have a high level of success, it's rare for them not to have one or more special mentors, people who, when they look back on their career, made a huge impact and really maybe even steered the course of history, so to speak, in a way that was positive and made a big contribution to your success. When you think about, you know, and reflect upon the past, do you have a couple of people that you could tell our listeners about that and kind of how they made a huge impact on you?
You know, I think with a lot of people, and I'm fortunate to, and I'm very cognizant of people that don't have great family resources. But I think it starts with my parents, who both taught me both, you know, a work ethic and taught me, you know, so we never get outworked. You know, I mean, I still can't get outworked. In fact, it's a sickness. And I think I came from my parents. And I think a level of confidence in the sense that, you know, it started with a good support system that my parents believed in me. And so the idea is, I think that, you know, it is so amazing to me how just a kind word to somebody, hey, that jacket looks great, Bill, or hey, you did a nice job on that meeting or something, how that can totally impact somebody positively, just like when you beat them down, it can have the other side of the effect. And I think my parents believing in me allowed me to have not all sense of belief, but said that if I would show up and be my very best and work as hard as I could, that everything would work out and my confidence didn't get shaken when bad things happened. You know, I would not allow those people to have, because I had a good grounding for my parents that's there. I remember my 20s meeting a guy who was the managing partner of a firm called Hannock Wiseman, a guy named Bud Devella, who was the, you know, one of the most respected attorneys and people in the industry. And as we were doing business together, I was referring business to them. I was referring business to him. And he referred a little business to me, but I referred business, more business to him. But it allowed a guy in his mid-20s to actually go to school and see how a guy who ran a major law firm operated. And it allowed me to go from just a kid with a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm, who was, you know, hopefully reasonably intelligent, to somebody who saw how the game was played a little bit. And then I was lucky enough to develop a joint relationship with, at that time, the largest non-Big Four accounting firm in the country, Rothstein Cass. And I saw how a guy like Harris Rothstein took a business that was, I want to say, pedestrian when he came on. It was a startup accounting firm, and he turned it into an economic powerhouse, and how he ran a business. And I want to thank him, because he didn't have to do it, but I was probably in my early 30s, and he took me under his wing, and he showed me the ropes, and I watched him, and I, you know, he was somebody that allowed me to really change how I thought about things. And, you know, and I think on top of that, Bill, you know, I could probably name a bunch of other people. And, you know, I think a lot of them become like, you know, Dan Sullivan would be a perfect guy, the strategic coach.
Sure.
You know, that's a PhD for people that are entrepreneurial thinking. You know, you want to read all the time. You know, I just don't want it to be intellectually lazy. I wanted to always be continuing learning and growing. And, you know, then it became almost like peer learning, you know, as we got involved with Fortune Management, to have a partner like Bernie Stoltz, where we've learned a lot from each other. The relationship that you and I have developed over the last decade or decade and a half has been one of the most important relationships in my life, in that we have somebody that, I don't know if mentor is the right word for each other. It's more peer-to-peer learning, where both parties are committed to help, to not only being their best, but helping everyone around them get better. And so the relationship I've had with you has been very, very important to me. And I could go, you know, I think we, you know, I'm sure I'm leaving people out, because we don't script these interviews. And
sure.
If I thought about it half hour, I'd probably think about it. I'm missing people. But I think the other idea is, what it does, though, is it allows us, as now people that are mentors to a lot of the younger people, to a lot of clients, a lot of younger people, a lot of people in our friends and community and past, is that I think we have an obligation to take the very best of what we've learned and help other people. I'm a human being, but I try to watch what I say. I try to be emotionally fit, because remember, Bill, like in your firm, your name's on the door. And I say this with love. You can't be an asshole anymore, because people actually listen to you. when you were a first year associate, you know, you could say whatever you want to say. Like, who cares? He said, 25-year-old junior attorney. Now the guy runs the damn firm. He's got to, you got to bite your tongue sometimes, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny. You're right. And one of my colleagues who I've worked with for over 20 years, and we have a friendship. I was once telling someone in a conversation, to paraphrase it, I was basically talking about how I viewed myself as a very, you know, approachable, down to earth guy, in touch with where I came from and all those, you know, all those things. And which I believe. And my colleague started laughing like really hard. And I said, well, why are you laughing so hard? And she said, well, because you're not that guy anymore. I said, what do you mean I'm not that guy anymore? You know, then all of a sudden, to your point, you get a little bit of perspective, like, about the position that you're in and the importance of what you say and what you do, because a lot of people don't know you for 20 years and, you know, are just getting to know you now and trying to understand what you stand for. And you can't just assume that people kind of know what you're all about. But one of the things that I think is a common thread in a lot of, you just talked about a lot of important people in your life, mentors, collaborators, people that made an impact. But, you know, the one common thread there, and I think it's the hardest thing for successful people to do, is every one of those people you mentioned dedicated time. They gave the most precious gift, right? Especially for hard charging entrepreneurs and successful people. Time is so limited. And to be a great mentor, you have to give your personal time, your personal interaction. You know, you don't change someone's lives as a mentor without spending your personal time on them and helping them and teaching them. And there's no way to mail that in. Like, you just have to do it. And not everybody can do it. And not everyone's equipped to do it or willing to do it. And I see that both outside and inside my organization, that not everyone is a born mentor, and some people focus so hard on their own productivity, they miss that aspect of their journey completely. So I think it's not only terrific that you had all these people that made such an impact on your life, but now, you know, you now pay that forward. And, you know, now you're looking back at all these people now that are having successful lives and careers. And you know, why we called the show Fingerprints on Success is because your fingerprints are on the success of a lot of people. And I think that's incredibly rewarding.
You know what I prize, you know, it's not the biggest part of our practice, but we represent, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 celebrities and athletes. It's not the major part of our practice, but it's there. And the thing that I noticed is, like, I never asked for tickets to the concert or for backstage passes for the TV show or the movie premiere, although I've gone to a few over the years, is that you see that everybody around them wants to befriend them. They want to see their backside. They want to be in the scene. And the idea is, I don't think they need one more groupie. They need somebody that they can trust and an advisor. And so I think that, you know, much like yourself and myself, is, and not everybody wants this, but I find in the very best relationships I have where I'm advising somebody, or when somebody's advising me, do I want to be embarrassed? No. Do I want to be called out publicly by people? But when you get to a position of authority and success, everybody's, you're beautiful, baby. You're beautiful, baby. Remember, you know, as you know, in the roles when you become successful, you can impact financially and otherwise the lives of a lot of people. So it's in their interest to, let's call it, for lack of a better word, kiss your backside or to be super nice to you. And sometimes the relationships are real, and oftentimes they're not.
Yeah.
But I think that what you want to do is you want to have a cadre of people that you trust that they can call you out and go, hey, you know what, Mark, maybe that wasn't your best self, or, you know, you're better than that. Or, you know, did you think about it this way, as opposed to, that's very helpful, as opposed to, you know, you're beautiful, baby. You know, and you're really not your best self. And I think that's where, you know, that's where the rubber hits the road, because it gets very intoxicating Like I've always said, like, people go, oh, that celebrity, once they became famous, or that athlete, they've changed. And I'd say that's partially true. I think it's everybody else who changes around them and wants a piece of that and wants to be, you know, and all that stuff. Or, you and I did a fundraiser for our favorite congressman, a few days ago. And, you know, we always laugh that when he lost his race, people weren't returning his call. But once he got elected, he had a million friends, you know?
Yeah.
You know,
everybody loves a winner.
It's amazing when you're the managing partner of a major law firm, how many friends you have, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you touched on something, I think, there too, for our entrepreneurs that are listening, and I'm sure that many or most can relate. Some of the most valuable people you can have in your organization are the ones who are comfortable, you know, respectfully calling you out on maybe you're not your best moment, or giving you advice or guidance, or saying, hey, you know, whether you decide to go this path or not, you know, I wouldn't do this, or I think that might be a mistake. And you know, what I think a lot of our entrepreneurs find is, in their organizations as they grow, you know, you could sometimes end up with a lot of people kind of like those celebrities, like, oh, you're so great, baby, you're so great. Because that, you know, people don't want to rub you the wrong way, because they're, you know, you're now in this important position. And really, the most valuable people in your entourage are the ones who can sit down and tell you when maybe there should have been a better path or a different way that something could have been accomplished. And you know, there's some real value there. So I think it's a great point. Mark, so here's another question for you. I want to kind of shift to, like, what I'll call, like, a current event topic. You know, when you're out there, you're advising people all over the country on, you know, on their businesses, on their lives, but financial and otherwise. When you look at kind of what's happening in the country right now, is there a current topic, a current issue, or something right now that you believe we should be navigating, we should be thinking about, that's, you know, kind of something you're wrestling with right now that you think our listeners should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think that you can talk about the stuff that everybody's talking about, whether this inflation we've had is under control, or or who's going to be elected president of the United States and who's going to control the Congress, or what the Supreme Court is going to decide on various issues that apply to one of your businesses or not. And I think about that all the time, and I opine on those things, and it's there. But I think when it comes down to its most basic form, what you really need to be is you need to be emotionally fit. You need to have emotional fitness, because regardless of what's going on in the world, there are opportunities. There are opportunities. And I think that what you have to do is I'm not afraid to be different, Bill. I'm afraid to be the same. And you want to think about different things. And, you know, like as an example, take somebody that I did get a call. It's so funny. I got a call driving into work this morning from somebody who thanked me. And I will tell you that, Bill, I don't even remember the conversation. They want to become a client. They may be working with one of our people. Remember, we're the people that help people create multi-generational wealth. And this is somebody, and I don't want to give their name because I'm going to give you some numbers and some other things. They happen to be a real estate agent, and they never made, they're supporting a couple of kids, a single woman, made $125,000in 2022, her best year ever. And if you know what's gone on in the real estate world in this area, interest rates have spiked. There's no inventory on the market. Most realtors are down 50% in terms of just the number of sales and actions that are going on. It's tough to be a realtor.
Yep.
And I don't remember, I remember speaking to her and I remember her, you know, being in a bad place because she goes, how am I going to feed my kids? I don't, you know, my ex-husband provides no support. I've got no money. I made $125,000, but, you know, last year, but if I make a lot less than that, we'll lose our house. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I remember I said to her this, you know, I said to her, well, that could be never the problem, Bill. It's how you think about the problem. And what I said to her, which I don't even remember, she told me this. I said to her, then your mindset has to go to what's great about that. And there's never been a better time to be in real estate. And she said to me, I said that I thought you were crazy when you said that to me. She said to me, why did you say that? I said, because you now have a unique once in a generation cycle to be able to buy real estate in 2023 at 2025 prices. And you could right set the market there. And then ultimately, when rates eventually come down, you'll then be able to refinance and get a double dip. And this has never been a better time to go buy real estate. And I've had that mantra. And she said, I want to let you know I'm doing my taxes now. And I made $225,000 last year. I made $100,000 more than I made. And I was ready to give up when I spoke to you. And I was afraid I was going to lose my house and my kids wouldn't be able to eat. And we made $100,000. We almost doubled our income. And, you know, it comes back to, I think that it's never the problem. It's never the problem in the world or who gets elected or who's the president of the United States or what happens with interest rates or inflation or the stock market or the real estate market. I think what people hire us to do, and that's not only me, it's you, but what they hire a key business strategist and critical thinker and financial advisor to do is not just help them create multi-generational wealth, but to be able to help to have those conversations about how they think about those issues, which are far more powerful than if you got 18% return in the market last year or 16%. And I'd rather you have 20 than 18. But the idea is, I think we focus on the do rather than on what's the critical piece. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, no, it does answer my question, and you know, it also makes me think of my next question, which is, and I love to ask this question of everyone because, you know, one of the things everybody loves to make money. If you're an entrepreneur, making money is one of the measuring sticks, right? I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people do what they do, and that's a measuring stick. But I always found that when people really reflect, there's always, you know, now the fashionable description is their why statement. You know, why is it that they do what they do? So why is it, Mark, that you do what you do? And I know that you work unbelievably hard. I maybe never met anyone in my life who, as you said yourself earlier in the interview, you know, you'll never get outworked. You know, it's not just about making money. What makes Mark Murphy tick? What drives you to do what you do every day?
First of all, I think I've got an amazing life because I just go from one thing I like to something I like more to something I like. I don't have a business life or a personal life. I have a life. I've got a great relationship with my family, with Lisa, with my kids, with friends. I take plenty of time to do what I want to do, go to a lot of games, go to, you know, support all the stuff I want to do. But I think the part of it is I never felt like I've worked a day in my life. Because I feel, Bill, I'm always at my best when I'm serving others. And so, you know, when I focus on that unique ability, and you know, and changing the lives of people who touch. That doesn't seem like work. I can't believe they pay you to go do this. I can't believe they pay you the kind of money we've had to be able to go do that. And so that's where I think that, you know, what you want to do is to do that. And I think so many folks, again, don't see it that way. You know, I think that they want to work less, or they want to do, of course you want to work less if you're not having fun at what you're doing. Who wants to do things you're not passionate about? You know, I don't view success just as money, although money is a pretty good yardstick for, you know, it's one measure. I think success is what I encourage our five kids to do is I just, whatever they do, I want them to be their very best at. You know, if you become a garbage man, I want you to be the best garbage man that we have. If you do something in your life, just be the very best you can be. Be the very best friend. Be the very best brother. Be the very best anything you could be. Be the very best of your ability. And most times money will follow. But there's a lot of professions, a lot of things where people don't make a lot of money at all. And they're as or more successful than the people that are making tens of millions of dollars or more. And I think that's the secret to life, is to be able to because I think when you do that and you're the very best at what you do, regardless of what you do in life, even in the smallest things, it's amazing how great and how joyous life is, how you're so caught up in the now and what's going on, and everything else sort of takes care of itself. So, you know, to me, I've always had a visualization where I kind of visualize what could be, you know, going forward. You know, especially when I was a little kid, when you don't have a lot of money growing up. So, you know, like I remember, like I did a couple of like egoic things, like when I moved to the city, you know, when you were a kid and you grew up dumb and broke and stuff in New York, you think that all the rich people live on Park Avenue. So when I moved into the city, they go, well, where do you want to look for apartments? And I go, any place that's on Park Avenue, because I just thought, you know, I had an apartment on Park Avenue or something. You know, I did some silly things like that. And I love the place over there, but I didn't look anywhere else other than Park Avenue. Cause you know, as a little boy, I go, wow, that's how, you know, people live. They live on Park Avenue or something like that. But having said that, I don't think that's important. I think that it's how I show up in every place in my life is the measure of who you are. And it's amazing how that snowballs into all the success in other areas. I think that everything is interconnected, the world. And, you know, it's, you know, one little thing over here can create big things over here.
Yeah. It's getting joy out of being a hero for others, which I right. always thought, in fact, I should ask you, like, I know that your podcast is called Hero of the Hour, and it obviously features, you know, all these great guests that you bring on in all different walks of life. But, you know, what you just described is being a hero for other people is kind of what charges you up.
You'll have to catch next week's episode. It's Abe Lipschitz's second cousins coming up. Actually, we've got some really good people coming up this season and some really powerful folks. Ask me the question again. I went for the joke instead of listening to the question. But
it was more of a comment, which is that, you know, you described, which is being a hero for other people, yeah. And I think
because ultimately you want to bring, you don't want people that bring you down. If you want to be a hero to somebody, and I know you do, all you want to do is be with, collaborate with, be in the company of people that want to be a hero to other people. And you want to collaborate together to create something that has never existed. You know, I always tell our young people, I always say, you know, like, and sometimes you'll see people that are in what's traditionally minority groups, people that work for little women, maybe in the LGBT community, maybe they're a minority. And, you know, and I'll hear them say something to the effect of, you know, or they're 22 years old, you know, they're a kid. And they go, you know, I want a seat at the table. And my mind goes to them, well, why would you want a seat at the table? Why don't you build your own damn table? Let's not work at getting, I don't want a seat. I don't want you to get a seat. I don't want to help you get a seat at somebody else's table. I want you to help you build your own table. What would that look like? Who should be at your table? What should your table do? What's that place? Let's focus on what's in creation and fascination mode. When you close your eyes and dream, what does that table look like? You know what someone else's table looks like. I'm not saying you couldn't have a seat there, but let's build our own.
I think it's great. That's great. So, Mark, I want to ask you one last question, and it's kind of a forward-looking question. You know, when you get up each day right now, you got a lot going on. what has you, what are you currently doing or working on that's got you super excited? What is Mark Murphy pumped up for in the future when you get up every day?
You know, first of all, I'm very grateful for Lisa DeMeo. You know, it took me 56 years or 57 years to find the right woman. All I can tell you is, for all of you listening out there, I spent my first, 56 years playing hard to get. And when I finally played hard to want, and then it worked out. But I think, we've never had that family life. Bill, I've got five kids now. We have a blended family. I've got two boys. At least he's got a boy and two girls. And, for us, it was Lord of the Flies. It was three men growing up and raising each other. And Lisa has created a family for us. And, if you read that, my last book, the one that was number one on Amazon, I opened the book with talking about our family and the jingle to the Brady Bunch jingle. And that's been the great joy of my life. Not writing songs or writing books, but having those five kids and having Lisa. And I think that's important to me because we never had that before, because you can't focus on what you don't have. And then when you have it, you feel it's really great. And then just like personally, I'm having fun. I just got elected to the national board at Indiana University, who's where Blooming's my pride and joy. And we've got a couple of two kids there and maybe a third on the way in August. And, I love Bloomington, Indiana, and my passion is Indiana basketball. And I'm just having such a ball, trying to make a difference in the university and trying to give back there. And as I've always, gotten focused on other things and that's the stuff. And then I also think that when you get to a place in your life that there are people that are outside my door right now, there are about 50 of them that have dedicated their lives, their careers to me and to our business. And I wake up every day with the tremendous responsibility that if I've been given that loyalty and that work ethic and that respect, that every day I've got to wake up to make sure that I'm doing my very best to create a bigger, better future for them. Not only Bernie Stoltz says it so well, and I've stolen that and many other things from Lantern as well, but every day I wake up thinking about a class three experience in our business. It's got to be great for the clients first. It's got to be great for our team second. And then it's got to be great for me third. And it's in that order. And, it's a great responsibility because it's bigger than you. And you have a responsibility to those people, going forward. That ultimately, when people say it's just a business or this is just business, that's not how I operate. I understand how people say that. To me, everything is personal. And I don't mean personal that I'm, angry or creating bitterness. It's personal in that all I can control is how I show up every day. And if I show up as the best version of myself, it's going to be a great day. And I learned that a lot from our friendship and working with you.
Well, Mark, I can't thank you enough. I'm very grateful. Thanks for sharing with everybody the fingerprints on your success. And it was really great having you on as a guest. And it's even better having you as a friend. I can't thank you enough for being on today. So thank you.
It's my pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Fingerprints on Success podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe on your chosen platform that you are listening to us on. If this episode made you think of someone, go ahead, take a screenshot and share this episode with them, or post it on your social media to share with your friends. You can catch the show notes for this episode and any mentioned links in the description of this episode. Mandelbaum Barrett PC specializes in partnering with successful business owners and proven entrepreneurs on all of their legal matters. Visit www.mblawfirm.com for more information. Once again, it's www.mblawfirm.com. We'll see you on the next episode.